Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. This Friday night is brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to speak to them for all your import and export finance needs. That's Africanacity. That's Absa. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. We'll chat to Peter Attard-Montalto about the new Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana's outing, first outing to foreign investors as Finance Minister. Fully appreciate that he has plenty of experience in dealing with international investors over many years of being the ANC's head of economic policy. But this is the first time that he is the Globe's go-to guy when it comes to go-to person. When it comes to the economy. Did the script differ markedly from that of Tito Mboweni? Certainly from what I have seen, it doesn't appear to have done so. So that discussion, it was today set up by S&P, the government mandating HSBC and Standard Bank to arrange this global investor call. That happened at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and the purpose was to introduce the minister to markets, and he was going to make some brief comments. We'll find out about those comments and how it went down. Gary McNamara from Sunland Private Wealth, the big question to him tonight came to me via a WhatsApp from a connection today. Should we sell Naspers? And we'll... Well, interesting thought. Should you sell Naspers? We'll talk about it. Then, Richard Bosman, who makes the most glorious meat products, cured meat products, influenced by the styles of Italians and Spaniards who have perfected the art over many, many years, and he does a very good job too. We'll wrap up the first hour with the Brutal Biz Quiz, and in between 7 and 8 this evening, bring you some of the best bits from the week that has been here on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, as I just said, the finance minister having his first call with international investors today, wearing his finance minister's hat. He's partial to a hat, is Enoch Godongwana. He's not an unknown person to them, thanks to years of head of economic policy for the ANC. It certainly does look, from what I've been reading today, that he's got the same script in his briefcase as Tito Mboweni. Peter Attard-Montalto, head of capital markets research at Intellidex. Did you manage to crack a nod to the call, Peter?
Good evening. Well, this was a call for everyone in the markets. I think there was media on it as well. It was the first outing, as you say. And very much he ticked all the right boxes, said all the right things. It was business continuity. It was fiscal framework being sacrosanct. It was backing of Operation Vulindlela and their structural reforms. And so it was very much what the market wanted to hear. And I think we will see a honeymoon period probably until at least the MTBPS, until some home truths start to actually hit home on the fiscal side.
Okay, so I mean, same script then. So basically, Tito Mboweni left a briefcase in the office with some notes. He picked up the same briefcase and then wheeled that briefcase out to international investors. It's deeply encouraging that that is the case, is it not?
Well, we should also remember this is a marketing exercise, and the market is mulling over if Enoch is actually business continuity. The most interesting thing about him, of course, is unlike even Tito to some degree, but probably Gordon before him and others, Enoch has been speaking to the market continually during the last decade as his period as head of the Economic Transformation Committee ANC. So the market is well aware already of his pro-coal views, for instance, his views on described assets he said in the past. So we are not seeing those ankles yet, and I think that's where we still have to see the proof in the pudding as we start getting difficult decisions having to be made by the minister. But we didn't get angles there. It was played very, very safe. Too safe, I think. Investors were a little disappointed. It was a 30-minute call. There was no Q&A with investors. We had very, very dry, boring questions from the two banks hosting the call, not to offend the minister. So we're waiting for a little more ankle, I think.
A little bit more ankle. So, yeah, we'll see. One of Tito Mboweni's frustrations, of course, that every time he was faced with difficult questions or difficult decisions and these decisions had to go to cabinet, is he had to give a course, basic course in Economics 101 to everybody in the room, or most of the people in the room anyway. And I think that began to rankle Tito Mboweni. You know, Gorogwana's going to have to do exactly the same thing, isn't he?
Well, that's always what he has been doing within the ANC to some degree, whether it's on Saab nationalisation, which he was roadblocking inside the party in the past, or on a more general conservative fiscal stance overall. The problem going forward, remember this was Tito's leaving comment that he said recently, was that issues like a base income grant may well actually be political and override Treasury views. And that's really the big issue and the big long-term structural fiscal issue the markets are really mulling at the moment, and where the position of Enoch versus Tito is very interesting to consider. Enoch has been in Cyril's kitchen cabinet since he came to power, is part of the CR17 project in a way that Tito was not. But even then, you know, the political realities may not mean, maybe he can deal with stakeholders better, et cetera, deal with unions, et cetera. But when push really comes to shove, does it mean he can actually get his way? Would he have been able to block SAA, for instance, in the past against Pravin Gordhan in a way that Tito couldn't? I'm a little sceptical on that.
Again, I don't know him. I've spent an hour once talking to him. He seems incredibly pragmatic, but it is, you can be as pragmatic as you like. If the political winds are against you, if there is pressure from within your party, pressure from within the cabinet of which you are a member, you're not the finance director of the company who can simply refuse to sign the checks, you have to make a decision as to whether you stay in or get out. Tito Mboweni, I think, was worried that his hard line on austerity would not be able to hold. And that's one of the reasons why perhaps he was keen to get out. I wonder if Enoch Godongwana has got greater political capital within the ANC, as you suggest he might have.
Well, it's only how much you can play that. And this is why the SAA point was so important. I think Tito always believed that Treasury had the final say, and it didn't, as we saw in the SAA case. But we should also set our expectations appropriately here. There was already set to be quite a bit of expenditure slippage, I think, over the medium run anyway, even if Tito had stayed on. For instance, especially the sort of 4% or so cuts in the coming years that were penciled in, say, for the security cluster, just are not possible now after the unrest. There was always demands building up even before we consider the basic income grant on the expenditure side. So we have to set our expectations a little bit carefully comparing the two of them. But ultimately, you know, the real test here is going to be what happens to the shape of the yield curve over time. It's exceptionally steep. The market hasn't magically priced out risk premium and the steepness of the yield curve just because we have a new finance minister. And this is the real test. As those debt service costs that are growing steadily over time and nibbling away at the capacity to spend on all the things we want to, on education and on health and the rest of it.
Just to put that into real numbers, if you consider if you had a 10 cent pieces on a table to make up a rand, two of those 10 cent pieces, 20 cents or 20% of every cent that South Africa collects goes directly to servicing debt. I mean, we've got a debt problem. Which is, it's I think I saw a number today just confirming the fact that we spend more on servicing debt than we do individually on education and health, for example. And here we are in an education and a health crisis, two of the biggest issues facing South Africa. And we've borrowed so much money to fund our lifestyles over the last, 10, 15 years, that money's got to get paid back to the people who lent it to us. And that's probably the biggest problem the finance minister's got.
Well, this is the biggest silent fiscal killer in the medium run, is this steady ratcheting up. Those numbers you were saying are rising moderately quickly over time and gobbling up more space in the budget. Now, the left in South Africa wants to magic money trees. They want MMT. And even if you believe that could work, theoretically, it's not going to happen because the person sitting at the top of the big tower of the Saab in Pretoria is not going to do that kind of policy. So the only way out you really have as a result, given tax rises would have detrimental impacts on the economy, is to establish fiscal credibility, is to establish a slow pace, a steady pace, a credible pace of fiscal conservatism over time. But that will only get you so far. You can't cut education. You can't cut health. There needs to be more support in the economy after the unrest. So really the only actual thing that can deliver you is expanding that revenue base through faster growth and reforms, and hence the importance of Operation Blue Level, the importance of things like the gazetting of Schedule 2 of the Electricity Regulation Act yesterday. These are the things that in the long term really are going to allow us to spend more on the social wage. This is what South Africa needs.
And that's the point. I mean, the finance minister also saying that, you know, major structural reforms will continue, including power generation. That's Gwede Mantashe's rules that you've just referred to, the opening up of spectrum, port operations, the things that the president has announced recently. I mean, all of these things are absolutely pivotal parts of this story. But in the meantime, we've got an economy where, I mean, the finance minister today saying that he will stick to Tito Mboweni's, where is the quote, the continue the sustainable fiscal path laid out by his predecessor. I suppose the big question is whether that fiscal path was indeed sustainable. If he does more of the same, does South Africa come out of this at the end in an okay shape, whenever that end is?
Well, that was always the problem in the past, is balancing of those rising debt service costs with the long-term pace of growth. The debt was going to maybe stabilize at exceptionally high levels, and given shocks over time, probably keep steadily increasing over time. But this is why we need, you know, ultimately more employment, more growth in the economy, and a faster pace of reform. Operation Vulela, Treasury and Presidency working together through that structure are starting to make some changes there. But, you know, I think I would disagree with your notion that the electricity reforms yesterday were Gwede Mantashe's baby. He was kicking and screaming to actually implement them in the end. But yes, we got there in the end yesterday. But, you know, I think this is the point. This is what frustrates me, for instance, so much about the basic income grant debate. We want the largest possible social wage, as it's called, the broad mix of grants and health and education spending, as possible. But we want it on a sustainable basis over time, not a big one-off splash that blows the whole thing up. And it's not sustainable. That's not fair to anyone, most of all the people receiving that social wage.
Completely. And the finance minister's head screwed on completely on this one. And, you know, he was quoted earlier this week and there was outrage from the left of the political divide when he was saying that, you know, you cannot have people dependent on grants. You cannot have people dependent on handouts. It's not good for anyone's psychology to be permanently on a handout. People want to work. People want the dignity of a great job and to advance themselves and the fortunes of their families. That's ideal. But you cannot do it in an environment that simply is not conducive to growth and creating those jobs. There's the problem.
So I disagree with him slightly on that comment. I think it was over-egging that argument too much. I think the issue here is in a resource-constrained environment, ultimately, where there isn't a magic money tree, what are you going to spend your extra rand on? And, you know, this is where you do need additional support after the unrest, say, as a temporary measure. But where is the biggest bang for your buck? What is the efficacy of this? This is where we need a lot more detail and you know, modeling into the basic income grant debate. And this is where other policy measures, such as employment, tax incentives, et cetera, have to be part of the mix as well. This is where, you know, spending some of the extra rand on NHI-type, you know, interventions are also important. I think we have to consider, you know, the basic income grant is only one element of how you make ultimately people, how you help people out of poverty.
Absolutely. Peter Attard-Montalto, the head of capital markets and research at Intellidex. No big swings and ructions and worries in the market. No great excitement either. The new finance minister playing a very, very careful game today. It's a marketing drive, says Peter Attard-Montalto. An introduction with him as finance minister, giving more of the same, which is exactly what he needed to do today. And that is what he delivered upon. Medium-term budget policy statement comes up in a couple of months' time. And the point being that's going to be the first test, because there's going to be a limited budget and he's going to have to cut the cloth to fit. And that is going to be his challenge as the new finance minister. But he is a solid, good pair of hands, exhibited that today. The new finance minister, Enoch Godongwana's first day out with international investors as finance minister, getting, I think, a tentative and cautious and quite positive thumbs up from Peter Attard-Montalto, the head of capital markets research at Intellidex.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Gary McNamara from Sundown Private Wealth is our market commentator this evening. Yeah, markets didn't respond either in any way, really, Gary McNamara. As Peter Attard-Montalto suggests, I suppose, time will test the finance minister's mettle.
Absolutely, Bruce. And if you go back to his initial appointment, I think Thursday last week, the Rand also didn't really react. So he is a safe pair of hands, I guess. As a complete independent, people will say he's probably a little bit more party-aligned than our previous minister. I was a bit of a Tito fan, but I think we've got a good set of hands, and hopefully he's got a difficult job on his hands, but it's a good start, and hopefully he's got some way forward on the medium-term budget speech, which will be key to addressing some of the issues we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an interesting week on markets. At one point this week, the top 40 index of the 40 biggest and most valuable companies on the market actually hit a record level. And then we just sort of sogged our way through the rest of the week.
We did, Bruce. And again, the big number on our markets is the Naspers story. If you look at the broader top 40, the commodities have held up reasonably well. Those commodity prices continuing to do well. Those companies really spewing a lot of cash. Even the South African Incorporated held up quite well, but because of the weighting in Naspers and the overhang with the corporate action and the uncertainty in China, certainly was the big driver initially positively during the start of the week, and then really, as you say, sagged in towards the end of the week.
I got a WhatsApp from somebody who's got my number. It says, the ordinary person in the street always gets left behind. Should I sell Naspers? And I said to them, I've got a hospital pass opportunity here for Gary McNamara from Sundown Private Wealth. I will ask him the question. So they're listening. Should this person be selling their Naspers shares, Gary?
Bruce, I don't think so. You know, you've got two very distinct schools of thought. You've obviously got the regulatory and the centralist control overhang in China, which has been well documented over the last couple of weeks and even months prior to that. But you are buying into a company that's economic value is significantly more than the share price is reflecting. And you're also getting exposure to a very fast-growing economic environment in the world. So short answer is yes, I would be a buyer at these levels. It's going to be a bit of a bumpy ride as the government continues with this regulatory tug of war with America and that, but I think it's very much in the share price, and I would certainly be a buyer at these levels.
I do, and again, you understand the stuff considerably better than I do, Gary, but I mean, I just look at the success of China and the explosion and expansion of its economy and its incredible economic prowess over the better part of the last two decades, and I just can't see that the president of China has got any intention of dramatically slowing down the advancement of that economy. He's got, you know, more than a billion mouths to feed. It is an economy that is transforming itself from a manufacturing economy to a consumption economy. And he needs to keep the wheels of this thing turning. I can't see himself shooting himself or the country in the foot.
Couldn't agree with you more, Bruce. And certainly that is what a lot of the broader analysts and bigger investment houses are suggesting as well. It's in nobody's interest to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. The guys that are supplying the capital, but bearing in mind they do still have a very strong view to do what's in the interests of the Chinese people. They're probably less worried about what the rest of the world thinks. But there's no doubt most people's view is that he's not going to kill off the support that's really grown. And I think also that economy, as you say, has really moved on so much over the last 10 or 15 years to really get it back to the way it was in terms of a strict control, regulated, very strong, less social media. I think it's going to be a very difficult task to get that over the line. But there will be regulations, but I'm certainly in your camp. I think he's not going to do too many draconian things in terms of the outlook going forward.
I hope you're right. Otherwise, my life becomes a misery, Gary, because people believe what we say. People believe what we say. Who knows? Now, listen, Massmart, that's taken a huge amount of strain. Trading update from Massmart this morning. The riots really took a big knock to Massmart because of its concentration in a few warehouses and warehouse operations rather than hundreds and hundreds of outlets. It got nailed, and nailed quite hard, disproportionately relative to others.
Absolutely, Bruce, and it's really been a tough story. I think if you go back 15 years, Walmart paid 138 rand for this company. It's trading at 55 rand, so it's been an absolute nightmare for them from that perspective. But certainly this trading update, there was two sections to it. You know, if you look at some of the sectors were doing a little bit better, again, off a low base. You're comparing it from the comparative period last year where the liquor sales were a lot better. The building and construction continues to do quite well with builders, warehouse, etc. But the broader business, the cash and carry, the food side, really very staid, not exciting. And then, as you say, the civil unrest, they did make the comment in the results that they are not going to be 100% covered from that perspective. So if you look at the same store growth, it was down about 12% across this reporting period, which is not exciting from that side. And they've really battled to get pricing through in terms of the outlets that they have. So again, a very disappointing and pretty much the same as what they've been reporting over the last couple of years. It's been a very poor investment for Walmart.
I saw Sid Vianello, who is a legendary analyst of the retail sector, today speculating that we could see a rights issue have to be done by Massmart. And I wonder whether or not you would concur with the fact that the group's balance sheet is looking quite vulnerable.
Bruce, yeah, it's a difficult one. I would have thought, you know, Walmart, given the size and their strength, if there is a need to do some sort of capital support from a balance sheet point of view, they would be big enough to support it. Because at these price levels, I know it has been very weak for a long period of time now, you are really diluting quite significantly where they initially started. So I would be surprised, but as you say, Sid's a very learned gentleman and he knows these things extremely well. But for my money, I would think if there is money to be have to be injected in, I think Walmart will come in and put the money in. They've been in there for too long now to really walk away.
I also saw Stadio came out with an update today. And Stadio, of course, out of the Curo stable, it's the multiversity, the tertiary education business and that was sort of funded early stages by PSG. It looks like it's benefiting quite substantially from the move to online, as adults looking to advance their skills are willing to pay to do online education, and they seem quite a nice uptick from that.
Absolutely, Bruce, and it's an interesting business story. I think it is in the right space in South Africa where people just really want to get on with it, educate their kids with less interference in terms of political or otherwise, and I think they're in a very good space. And as you say, I think the move to online, they're nimble enough and they can embrace that type of move going forward. So I think it's quite an exciting side of the business that's going to do quite well over the next couple of years.
Yeah, Stadio's trading update today. Naspers, hold on to your hats, your shares, and maybe go to church an extra time this year. Gary McNamara from Sundum Private Wealth. Thank you very much, Gary, for your views tonight.
On The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Transact securely online with Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. That's Africanacity. That's Absa. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Trade Management Online. Now's the time to speak to them for all your import and export finance needs. That's Africanacity. That's Absa. Absa is a registered FSP. In a couple of minutes' time, Richard Bosman, who is the owner at Richard Bosman's Quality Cured Meats. What is his job? He's not a butcher. Is he a butcher? Or is he a craftsman, an artist, a purveyor of delicious meats? We'll talk to him about that in our Friday file in just a moment. Also play the Brutal Biz quiz and between 7 and 8 this evening, the best bits of The Money Show. But first, let me tell you what's next on The Money Show as we go through results season, talking to chief executives of South Africa's biggest and most powerful companies. Next time, it is Jason Quinn at Absa and Fleetwood Grobler at Sasol, taking us through financial results and looking to the future. Business book with Bronwyn Williams at Flux Trends called Conflict on How to Argue Better. And Nina Hasty, stand-up comedian for Other People's Money. That's all coming up next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Richard Bosman is with us. He is the owner of Richard Bosman's Quality Cured Meat. Are you a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, or just an artist?
Hello, Bruce. Thanks very much for having me on your show. I'm none of those things. I am what the French would call a charcutier, somebody who makes cured meat products.
It sounds much better in French. How did you even start? I mean, were you a kid who, you know, would take bits of raw meat and leave them out in the sun to see what happened? How did it start for you?
Not at all. I actually studied a BCom with information systems and then lost my way somewhere along the way. And eventually, after a career in retail, I ended up owning a little delicatessen selling imported cured meat products. And while I was doing that, I started at home just making a little bit of stuff for fun as a hobby. And one thing led to the next. And in 2009, I started my business in Cape Town.
Okay, where was the deli?
In Hermanus.
In Hermanus, okay. And so you're importing other people's meats, and I mean, you're getting a selection, I'm sure, because there's a very strong European tradition, and I'm sure in many other parts of the world as well, but particularly a European tradition. The Spaniards are very good at curing meats. The Italians are particularly good at curing meats. If you like your meats really smoky, then you go German. Where was the biggest influence from?
Gosh, that's difficult to say. I think, as you rightly point out, you know, every culture has a tradition of preserving food. And in South Africa, we have biltong as our staple dried meat type of products, whereas in Europe, the climate lends itself far more to being able to slow dry cure products like Parma ham and jamon in Spain. Germany has much higher humidity, which results in a lot more of the products being smoked, because the smoke tends to dry out the product more quickly and allows you to be able to make those types of products at a high humidity.
But your
food was a passion for me. Food was a passion for me once I left home, and I've always enjoyed cooking and sort of managed to turn a hobby into a career.
Very few people succeed at that. I mean, just because you like doing it doesn't mean you can make a business out of it. And you've succeeded, because, I mean, we'll talk about your distribution and all of that in just a moment. I mean, I think your focus really is Italian and Spanish meats when I look at it, the curing of meat rather than the smoking of meat, although I think you do have a little bit of smoke from time to time, because one can smell it through the packets.
We do mostly dry curing, and we do a little bit of smoking, some of our chorizos and some of our dry cured bacons.
Bacon, oh, the bacon. But primarily sort of an Italian and Spanish influence. And I mean, just from that sort of influence, I suppose, and the Italians and the Spaniards would be fairly similar on this, that when you slaughter a pig, there isn't a piece that doesn't go unused.
100% correct. You have to use everything. Firstly, out of respect for the animal, if you're going to eat meat, you need to make sure that you treat it the right way and you use everything. And secondly, you know, as a businessman, if I didn't utilize everything, I wouldn't be able to actually make a profit.
Yeah, this is true. You don't grow your own pigs. You source pigs from suppliers. How do you go about doing that?
I deal directly with a couple of farmers who produce free-range pork, and I buy pigs that are bred to our specifications. They tend to be a lot bigger than the normal fresh pork carcasses that end up in the supermarket, and the quality is phenomenal. We really have the most amazing raw materials in this country.
When you talk about quality, I think people get a bit perplexed by this idea of quality, but it is getting the balance, I suppose, between meat and fat, for example, because if you're not feeding properly, if you're not looking after the animals properly, if you're not treating them properly from a health perspective, and you're pumping them full of antibiotics and medicines and things just to keep them going in big breeding sheds, for example, you're not going to get a great quality product.
That's exactly right. And the pork that we get is a much darker color. There's absolutely no smell to the meat. You know, often if you buy sort of that mass-produced pork in the supermarket, it has a slightly, you know, uric, you know, aroma to it, which is very off-putting. The meat's a very pale color, and it's quite soft and sticky often, whereas we get much higher quality meat without any smell. It's a dark red color, much drier meat, and it's a beauty to work with.
The focus on the small delis and the wine farms and the top end hotels, it's positioned you from a brand perspective in a really nice space as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've always tried to focus on that sort of niche upper tier market. It's not something that people buy every day, but it's something that we hope that they enjoy, you know, from time to time when they want to splash out and spoil themselves. And wine estates, as you point out, is quite a big part of our customer base.
And you've got a retail strategy as well. You're not in every Checkers, not in every Spa, but you are in, and I don't know how you identify the ones that you want to be in, or do they say, we'll put it into these 10 or 20 or whatever the case is. How does that retail strategy work?
It's a relationship with the retailer, and it's identifying the right profile store. So as you said, it doesn't work in every single Spa or every single Checkers. It's about picking the ones that have the right customers that are shopping in those areas and testing it out. And bizarrely enough, it doesn't always, you know, follow the normal sort of obvious thing that you would expect. Sometimes you sell quite well in smaller stores that have a little catchment of a clientele, whether they might be from overseas or just more affluent. But it doesn't work in every store, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You need to, and also not every product works in every store. So, you know, we make some fairly obscure products like guanciale, which is made from the cheek, and things like nduja, which is a very spicy, spreadable chorizo paste. And only a certain type of customer will go for those products.
And where might those sell?
We sell quite a lot at the Aranzazi Farmers Market in Cape Town at the waterfront, and then high upmarket delis like the Olive Branch in Kloof Street, and
that's the point, though. I mean, it is in urban areas generally. It is where the big migrant populations, people who like traditional foods, are more likely to be buying this sort of stuff. Being a specialist provider in the way that you are, do you ever see yourself getting big, you know, in terms of like growing your volumes 10, 20 times over the next 10, 20 years?
We'll never be in that type of market. It's just in South Africa, the market itself is too small. In terms of, you know, you mentioned Italy and Spain, people over there eat this type of food, you know, sort of several times a week. Whereas in South Africa, it's far more of a occasional type of purchase or enjoyment. And I don't want to be the biggest. You know, it's not fun being in charge of millions and millions of people and staff and products. I'd much rather focus on being the best than being the biggest.
And just maintaining that position, frankly. And when you say it's fun, are you constantly experimenting? Are you still playing? Or have you now settled into a rhythm saying, I have got a portfolio of product here. This is historically all the stuff that people have ever produced. It must be the best that it can be. And happy with the portfolio, or do you expand it?
We have a core range that we continue to produce, and then we do play around all the time. That's what keeps us interested and inspired, and it's fun. You know, to give you an example, I got some amazing pistachio nuts from a farm in Prisca recently, and we've now created a terrine with pistachio nuts and a salami with pistachio nuts. Stop. And it's a very small production run that we sell at the farmers market, and some of the products are on our website for home delivery, which you can order online. But they're never going to be in a Checkers or a Spa, you know, or a supermarket type of environment. They're just too niche and small production runs.
I love the adventurousness of it, Richard, and the product is awesome, and it's lovely to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on our Friday File here on The Money Show. Richard Bosman is the owner of Richard Bosman Quality Cured Meats. I should have done the vegetarian warning at the beginning of it, but I think it's just interesting, even if you are averse to meat. It is a lovely ethos to the business, and the products are exceptional. Thank you, Richard Bosman. Coming up in a moment, the Brutal Biz Quiz, before we wrap up the first hour of The Money Show. Your opportunity to get bragging rights and to show off to everybody and to make your own t-shirt. I am the Wizard of the Biz Quiz. You can do that on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Give us a call right now. First question this evening: who was the longest serving Miss Universe in history? Give us a call on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. The longest serving Miss Universe in history. You don't have to look very far at all.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Brutal Biz Quiz time on a Friday night. Lebo in Alberton. Who's the longest serving Miss Universe in history?
I think it's Zazibini Tunzi, Bruce.
Correct. Absolutely. She is the longest reigning Miss Universe, breaking a previous record held by 2011's Miss Universe, who held the title for 464 days. I think COVID has helped, and she was, of course, on Other People's Money on Monday. Who has given Reebok the boot?
Oh, damn.
It's a global athletics brand that used to own Reebok. I just like the question of who's given Reebok the boot. But essentially, who used to own Reebok?
Isn't it Adidas?
Correct. I like the pregnant pause. Sorry. Yes, Adidas. Yeah, it's selling Reebok for 36 billion rand, much less than they wanted, because they paid a lot more for Reebok, but they just couldn't make it work, and Adidas is just cooler. What could cost Eskom as much as 40 billion rand to fix?
Oh, that's
I'm going to have to get brutal on you, Lebo. Oh, Lebo is gone. Thank you for playing, Lebo. Oh, by Lebo. What about you, Sarah, in Rudderport? What could cost Eskom as much as 40 billion rand to fix?
Free electricity?
No, that would they wouldn't cover the cost for that, I'm afraid. Victor in Sunning Hill?
Madupi Power Station?
Madupi Power Station is absolutely right. The explosion at Unit 4 last weekend could cost between 20 and 40 billion, 2 years of work, and we're waiting for load shedding. Which quick service restaurant can you now send an SMS to, and they'll get you 2 pieces of chicken, chips and a Coke? You can order via SMS, via text.
KFC?
Correct. Well deduced, Victor, in Sunning Hill. Absolutely, KFC. Slightly more higher grade question for you this evening. MTN and Sanlam have got two bosses. MTN's boss is Ralph Mupita. Sanlam's is Paul Hanratty. Previously, they worked together where?
At Old Mutual.
Correct. Very good, Sir Victor. Very good. They announced a strategic alliance yesterday, the Sanlam and MTN, and it helps that the bosses used to work together. Who was the first ever General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers?
Sir Ramaphosa.
Victor, you sound so uncertain. But you're absolutely right, yes. Victor and Sunny Girl. Bragging rights for the entire week. Make your own T-shirt, Victor. Well done to you. I am the whiz of the biz quiz. You can say that. He was the first General Secretary of the NUM in 1982. And a lovely, lovely man who was part of the, what was then, I suppose, the Chamber of Mines, was a negotiator with Cyril Ramaphosa. A dear friend of my dad's, and this dear old man died this week. His name was Harvey Pierce, he used to win in the dark days of apartheid. So Harvey Pierce would say great things about Cyril Ramaphosa. He admired the guy, I think, way back then, at a very, very different time.